plan and execute what we did last weekend. So they had a lot to do with the meals and the organization of different events, the activities that you could do. Let me ask our anniversary team, would you stand for just a minute? Go ahead, stand. Don't be ashamed. Rick and or Pat is back there. Carol. And we had Gene, who's back in the sound room. He was there. So these five folks did a lot of the work. You may have seen Coleman and Gene back in the kitchen cooking the men's breakfast. You probably saw Carol and Pat doing the work to organize the dinner last week. You heard Olive and Coleman as they gave their testimony last Sunday and did a lot of other administrative things to get us organized. Would you give them a round of applause? Say thank you. Thank you. Please be seated. I came along for the ride. I just kept them organized and meeting, that's all. They got tired of meeting and they didn't want to be organized. No, that's not true. This has, however, was kind of the culmination of what we've been doing for about 6 months in the church. You remember back in January we started talking about 40 days of prayer. That was something that the anniversary team a long time ago said, we want to do something for the church, for the members of the church, to encourage them spiritually and build them up spiritually before we come to our anniversary. We want to have a strong church. And so when we came upon this curriculum, they said, that's what we need. That's what we need. And so Rick and his team of leaders led us through 40 days of prayer. And most of you, were you involved in it? Put your hand up. You were involved in 40 days of prayer. Almost everybody here was involved in a small group in 40 days of prayer. And I know you were blessed by that, and there's continuing blessings as a result of it. Then some of you took on the job of prayer walking your neighborhoods, and you've been praying for the people in your neighborhoods, and you did that in April and May. And then we had this wonderful celebration where we had lots of folks return, both from outside the area and from inside the area. And you know, to a person, every one of them who spoke to me personally said thank you. They said this was a great experience coming back and seeing new people that we hadn't seen before, meeting with the people that we knew before, renewing some of the stories and the memories. Thank you. Wes and Pat Brown had written us a little thank you note, and it's out on the entryway bulletin board, so you might want to look at that before you leave. But they were all grateful. But you know, it's a binding thing for the church, too. It binds us together. It binds us in fellowship. It binds us in commitment. It binds us in a desire to move ahead together as the people of God, and to renew the things that are of value to us, and to remind ourselves of those. And so I know we're going to spend this next 6 months of this year continuing to try to do what God wants us to do. Some of you yesterday were out serving our community. You went over to the Bridgeport Rescue Mission's Stuff-A-Truck outreach over at the Stop and Shop here on the north end of Bridgeport, and I got good reports. Pretty much our church ended up staffing that. We didn't think we were going to staff the whole day, but we did. Claudette Allen helped arrange that, called people, got people to change the times that they were going to come, got a few more volunteers. And I was told that the van that they had there was almost full of groceries by the time that they left. And one of you said to me this morning, said, you know what this did was this renewed my faith in humankind. Said, you know, to see people... told me about a fellow who had given the invitation to get some food to, middle-aged guy, single man. Went in, he said, I'll see what I can do to help. He goes in, comes back out, he's pushing a grocery cart, and he's got a bag of groceries. And Ron says, you know, I was expecting that he was going to hand me the bag of groceries and take his cart back to his car. He did just the opposite. He said, here, this cart is for the Bridgeport Rescue Mission. These are my groceries. Yeah, there are a lot of good-hearted people who lack the opportunity sometimes to give and to show their love. It was an opportunity to do that. People gave money. People gave food. Wonderful experience. And so thank you for those of you that helped do that. That's a very Christ-like thing to do and went for a very good cause. Today I'm going to start a series of messages. I'm not taking them in the order in which I originally thought I would take them, and I'll explain the reason for that in just a few minutes. But we're going to take a series of messages on ordinary people making extraordinary differences. Ordinary people making extraordinary differences. And what I mean is people who just look like and seem to be like everybody else you know. Not people with particular gifts or talents or abilities that would make them shine, that would get them on some sort of stage or spotlight someplace, but just ordinary people. I wonder how many of you would probably consider yourself ordinary. No shame in that, okay? How many of you think you're extraordinary? Okay, no, I won't do that. Okay, thank you. You know, Geraldine, it's honest, it's refreshing, it's totally wrong, but at any rate, no. Thank you, Geraldine. The rest of us rather think of ourselves as ordinary. Now, by the word extraordinary, what I mean is that ordinary people did things that most other people wouldn't think ordinary people could do. They had an impact that would seem like most ordinary people doing what they do would not have. And we find a number of those people in the New Testament. And I'm steering away from the disciples, from the apostles. We're not going to look at those people. You're going to think, well, they were extraordinary. They got to spend 3 years with Jesus, and they had a special calling, and they had special training and all of that kind of stuff. They're special. They're not like me. I didn't get that. We're going to look at the ordinary people. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to preach this series is because we've been talking about pushing back the needle on lostness in this area. And I'm convinced, and I think you must be as well, that we're not going to budge the needle at all unless it's primarily done by ordinary people. There aren't enough professionals in ministry. There aren't enough people with the gift of evangelism. There aren't enough people who've been to seminary in this area that they are collectively going to be able to do much to push the needle back on lostness in this area. Remember, a 1% change is a whole lot of people. 32,000 people, something like that. For just a 1% change, or 3,200 people, for just a 1% change in lostness in this area. And so you get all the preachers together and all the staff members and all the seminary people together, and they're not going to be able to do that. It's going to be ordinary people. If you've been in our Three Circles training, our trainer has a little statement. It isn't the pros, but it's the Joes who are going to make all the difference. And so I wanted to have a chance to look at some of the ordinary people of the Bible and see what is it that they did, how did they use the gifts and abilities God had given them, the resources God had given them, so that they made an extraordinary impact. Hopefully to encourage you to believe that you might make an extraordinary impact, even though you feel you're a very ordinary person. Now, the difference between an ordinary person who just does the ordinary and an ordinary person who does the extraordinary is well illustrated in this person that we're going to look at today. Now, this woman did something that almost all of us in this room can do. In fact, I would probably not hesitate to say, in fact, all of us in this room can do. But she was the one who did it. And others perhaps who had the opportunity did not. And that's what made the difference in her ordinariness being used in an extraordinary way. We've been introduced to this lady before because recently when I preached on great conversion stories of the New Testament, we talked about this lady. She's found in the book of Acts. And I'd like to invite you to turn to Acts chapter 16 to get her brief story. And then we'll talk about what that could mean to us today. Page 960 in the Pew Bible, Acts chapter 16. And we're going to be reading in verses 13 through 15. But let me give you the background so you'll remember. Paul is on his second missionary journey. He doesn't have Barnabas with him this time. He has Silas. And along the way, he's picked up Timothy. And they are had all intentions to revisit the churches they had planted in Asia Minor and then continue throughout Asia Minor trying to plant new churches, but God would not allow them to do that. He continued to close off opportunities for them to go anywhere but further west. And eventually they got as far west as you can get in the Asian continent, and there was the ocean. And it was at that point that Paul had a vision. A man from across the sea in Europe, in Macedonia, the northern part of Greece, was calling them to come over and help them. And they immediately realized this was God's message. You come over and work in Greece. So having no other place to go and having a clear direction from God, they set sail and they went to Greece. And within a few days, they were in the Roman colony of Philippi. And there in Philippi, there was no Jewish synagogue. And so we're going to pick up the story about what they did. Paul's normal practice was to find the Jewish synagogue and explain Jesus as the Messiah from the Hebrew Scriptures. But there was no such thing in Philippi. And so there weren't enough Jewish people in Philippi to form a synagogue. 10 families, 10 men was enough to make a synagogue. Apparently they didn't have that. And so it says here in chapter 16, beginning at verse 13, on the Sabbath day we went outside the gate to a riverside where we were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled. A woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening. And the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. Now keep your finger there. And if you have to, you can turn over a page like I have to turn over to the last verse of this chapter. And verse 40 says, they went out of the prison and entered the house of Lydia, and when they saw the brethren, they encouraged them and departed from them. Lydia's home became the place, the center of ministry to this Roman colony, this pagan town of Philippi. Now, we do know some things, we've talked about Lydia before, we do know some things about her that are of interest to us. The first is that she was from Thyatira. Guess what? Thyatira was one of those places that Paul tried to go to before he found all of the roads blocked by the Holy Spirit and he had to keep going west. If he'd gone south, he would have gone to Thyatira. But guess what? He would have missed Lydia. Lydia wouldn't have been there. Because Lydia was a businesswoman, a little bit unusual for that day. She sold the fabrics that were created in her area using the rich purple dye that the Thyatirans knew how to make. Now, purple was material for wealthy people. Purple and scarlet. And so it was not a mundane business that she had. She went to Philippi and opened up the Maserati dealership. And you know not everybody can afford a Maserati. And you know that those who can afford a Maserati are willing to pay a pretty good price for it, and the people that sell them make a pretty good living. Okay? She went and opened up shop selling the purple-dyed fabrics of Thyatira, and she must have done pretty well. Because this we know, that she had her own home, and she had household servants. She had an entire house full of people who served her. Some of them probably helped her in her business. Others simply took care of the house. And it must have been a decent size house because there was room in that house for Paul and Silas and Timothy and their other traveling companions. And then apparently there was room for all the brethren and the sistren all the brothers and sisters to gather for worship on a regular basis or for teaching in that house. So what is it that she did? Well, it seems so ordinary. And she really is an ordinary person, even though she had this opportunity to do quite a prestigious job and to probably make a good living from it. What she did was simply opened up her home to the missionaries. But that had a significant impact on the work that Paul and Silas could do, because they had a place to stay and they had all their needs taken care of by this fairly well-to-do businesswoman who became the first European convert in Paul's ministry. Now, Paul, at other times, as you well know, ended up having to support himself. He would usually be taken in by somebody, but in terms of feeding himself and taking care of his needs and maybe even having enough money to have food for Timothy and Silas and others, he would do his work. He was a tent maker by trade, and he would work. And he sometimes talked about how day and night he would labor in order to be able to support his ministry. Not in Philippi. There was a woman that said to Paul, "Paul, I'm going to take care of all of your needs. You come into my house and you don't have to worry about a thing. If you need it, it's yours. I just want you to spend 100% of your time preaching the gospel in Philippi." Now, I want you to think about the fact that this Philippian church was an outstanding church by the time Paul left. One of the things that Paul remembered this church for, and you'll read about that in his letter to the Philippians, is he remembered their partnership in the gospel from the first day. In other words, they didn't just let Paul do the work. They co-labored with him. And you've got to think of Lydia. You've got to think of Lydia working her business context to try to bring people to Jesus Christ. You've got to think of Lydia of trying to influence her neighbors and friends to becoming to Christ. She was a co-laborer along with the other new Christians in Philippi in the ministry of the gospel. Paul doesn't say that to any other group, but he says it to the Philippians. Second thing, Paul acknowledges that the Philippians, after he'd left, still had their hearts wrapped up in his ministry, and they sent financial gifts so that he would not have to work like he would normally work when he went to other places. And he mentioned specifically Thessalonica, the next place that he left Philippi, that Thessalonica, he said, "More than once you sent to take care of my needs." Now, I don't know how many wealthy people there were in Philippi, but I've got a suspicion that Lydia contributed significantly to those offerings that were sent to Paul. Later on, when Paul was in prison in Rome and he was writing the Philippian letter, he wrote it at least in part to acknowledge that they had sent through one of their people another financial gift to help support him while he was in prison. So here's a church that Lydia actually had a lot to do with establishing, but she wasn't a preacher. She wasn't a Bible scholar. She didn't know the Old Testament. She undoubtedly couldn't read Hebrew. But what she could do was do what? She could open up her house and she could provide a meal. Now, today what I want to talk about is this idea of extending Christian hospitality to other people. That's the thing that I think everybody in this room can do. And I'm going to boil it down just a little bit in just a minute. This idea of extending hospitality or friendship to others is a very biblical concept, isn't it? Because you can trace that back all the way back to the book of Genesis and how travelers would be accommodated in individual people's homes in the town where they spent the night. They would be provided food and they would be provided shelter. They'd be given a meal in the morning and then they would move on in their travels. And we read of a number of different times in which that hospitality was extended. And throughout the Old Testament, this concept that you will take care of those who come, the stranger that comes into your midst, that you'll not refuse them, you'll not abuse them, you'll not mistreat them, but that you'll provide for them and take care of them is a theme throughout the Old Testament. The New Testament adopts it. And there's a word, a Greek word, that's used to specifically refer to this idea of what we call hospitality. But it's a Greek word, a compound word, that means love of strangers. Love of strangers. Hospitality is love shown to strangers. Okay? And so that's what Lydia did. These guys were pretty much strangers to her. She'd only met them down there by the riverside. But once she'd met them, heard their message, received Christ as her Savior, well, they really weren't strangers anymore at that point, but they came to her house. She was extending friendship to strangers. And we're commanded to do this. You know, Book of Romans, Paul says that we are to contribute to the needs of the saints and practice hospitality. In Hebrews, he says, don't neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have been entertaining angels without knowing it. Happened to Abraham. In 1 Peter, Peter says, be hospitable to each other. Show love for strangers. Love for, strangers with one another, to one another without complaint. And he singles out in 1 Timothy, Paul singles out in 1 Timothy chapter 3, overseers, leaders of the church, pastors. He said, the overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, and hospitable, and able to teach. The practice of hospitality is something that's very much a part of the Old Testament world and the world that Jesus grew up in. So what Lydia did is not surprising. She might have offered it to others, but that the fact that she did it immediately upon her conversion made a big difference in his ministry in Philippi, and the connection that was built between them continued to make a difference in Paul's life, almost certainly. Now we see the action of hospitality even in places where the word hospitality does not occur. One of the most famous of those is another person who you would know as practicing hospitality. It's the lady Martha. Do you remember her? Now as they were traveling along, Luke chapter 10, he entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home, practiced hospitality. She had a sister called Mary who was seated at the Lord's feet listening to his word. Now, you know that that account goes on to talk about the little conflict between Mary and Martha, because Mary didn't want to fix the food. She wanted to just listen to Jesus. And Martha felt like she had to put on a feast, and so she was cumbered with much serving, the King James Version says. And so she was just really fed up that Mary wasn't helping her. And some dialogue ensued about that. But the important thing here is, here's Martha extending fellowship to Jesus. It happens again over in John's Gospel just before his crucifixion, his last trip to Jerusalem. John 12, Jesus, therefore, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him a supper there, and Martha was serving, but Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with them. This gathering together, particularly gathering together for a meal, was a characteristic of the early church. Acts chapter 2, verse 46 says, day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart. In fact, we read in the New Testament about one man who, after he became a believer in Jesus Christ, was called to be a follower of Jesus through a luncheon or a dinner for all of his friends, other people that needed to know Jesus. Luke's gospel tells us he went out, noticed a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, follow me. And he left everything behind and got up and began to follow him. And Levi gave a great reception for him in his house, and there was a great crowd of tax collectors and other people who were reclining at the table with him. He just invited his other tax collecting friends, and said, come and meet this guy. I've just become his follower. He's accepted me. In the New Testament, then, we see meals that are shared with fellow believers. We see meals that help build relationships and give mutual support to one another. We see meals shared with those who are not yet followers of Christ so that they might get to know him. Now, why am I focusing on Lydia and this issue of hospitality? Well, because it seems to be so out of the ordinary today. We live such rushed and busy lives that some of us never sit down with each other and have a meal. We grab something on the go. And having a meal at home is sometimes, for some of us, a rather special occasion when it ought to be much more routine. But at any rate, hospitality seems to be terribly out of practice. But I'm convinced it's one of the most powerful tools that we own, that we all have, to make an impact on the lives of people around us. Just like Lydia made a huge difference in that church getting started in Philippi, her hospitality is a model for us about the impact that just the simple thing of inviting somebody into our home to have a meal can make on their lives. Now, I want to focus on just that one aspect this morning of hospitality. Back in Jesus' day, it was important to let somebody sleep in your home because there weren't safe places in most cases for people to rent lodging or do something like that when they traveled. So Jewish people, and then Christians after them, practiced hospitality, inviting people, travelers, into their own home. We don't need to do that so much today, but we still have the tool available to us of inviting people to share meals. Let me talk, first of all, for just a moment about something that you would be well aware of, the power of a shared meal. Power of a shared meal. There's hardly anything, I think, more personal, more thoughtful, nor something that breaks down the walls between people more than sitting down at a table together and having a meal. Why do you think we had breakfast last week together? Why do you think we had dinner last week together? Why do you think some of us went out to brunch together? Because in those conversations around the table and the fellowship that we enjoyed with one another, a quality of relationship, a depth of relationship, a level of love is established that we wouldn't have shaking hands in the hallway, holding a coffee cup in our hands. And so there's tremendous power and intimacy that's possible when you invite somebody into your own home. It can make a huge difference. When Katie and I were young marrieds, we were living in New Hampshire, but we were going to a church in Vermont, small church. And there was a slightly older couple there that invited us to enjoy dinner at their house regularly on Sunday evenings. Not every month, every week, but about once a month. And we still remember them, and I still clearly remember the dining room that we had our meals in. They had kids. We got invited to their house, and we had meals together. Katie, you remember that, right? Tom. Tom and his wife. Now she remembers. Tom, what's Tom's wife's name? Lived in White River Junction. I don't remember his name. Had two kids. Invited us to their house. She's pleased. I'm 70. She acts like it. Sorry. She's forgotten. I'll tell a couple more. Maybe I'll remind my wife about these good times. But I remember that. And I remember being invited to their table. I remember the dining room, sitting there, because we wouldn't just have a meal together. We'd have an extended conversation. Christian fellowship with each other. When we were still young marrieds and living in Colorado, another slightly older couple invited us to join them at their house after church on Sunday night. I know. I'm not accusing you of anything bad. I'm just asking you to remember. Phil and Judy had a regular group of young married couples who were always invited to their home, and when they could come, they would come after the Sunday night service. Now, it wasn't meals, but often it was snacks or a dessert or something like that that Judy had prepared. But there was lots of conversation, and we could bring our kids because they had older kids and kids that were about our age. So it worked out just really well. And I definitely remember that couple. We've stayed in touch. And I remember their home very well. When we moved to seminary, we lived in a little town called Justin, Texas. If you're watching in from off outside this area, Justin is not the place where Justin Boots comes from. It's just a little farm town north of Fort Worth. It's probably not as little as it was when we were there. Now, we found what happens in most small towns, that most of the people that lived in that town had lived there almost all of their life, if not all their life. And so most of their friendships and social relationships were already established. And so while they were friendly, we didn't get any invitations from most of them to ever go and have a meal with them or visit with them in their home. However, there were a few other people who were like us, people who'd moved into the town sometime after their birth, usually as adults, and they found the same thing, that they didn't always get invited anywhere. So they were kind, and a couple of those couples invited us to their homes and our children with them, and we enjoyed intimacy and fellowship, conversation with them, and I remember them very clearly, and I remember their homes. Now, why? Because sharing a meal together, being invited into somebody else's home, is a powerful way to deepen friendship and fellowship, to break down barriers, and to make people feel loved. And so Katie and I have experienced that. Since moving to Connecticut, we've had invitations to many, many homes, many of your homes, and those who lived here before and moved away. And all of those visits are in one way or another memorable to us. Some were cookouts, some were potluck meals, others were fancy sit-down dinners. It didn't make any difference. We had a lovely time at every one of those, and we feel closer to each one of those people that we got invited to their home. So you want to feel closer to your pastor? Put a good meal together and invite me. I'm kidding, sort of. But it still would be nice, because you should extend fellowship to a lot of other people. But if we get overlooked and you invite others, that would be fine. The power of a shared meal. Can anybody else here say, you know, I've had shared meals with other people that were not members of my family, not close friends, and it drew me closer to them? Has anybody got that experience? I don't think you can avoid that if you've had that experience. And so that's a wonderful tool. Think of this. Some of you are sitting here saying, I don't know my neighbors. I mean, they come in, they go out. I see them sometimes in the yard. I really don't know my neighbors. What am I going to do to get to know my neighbors? What are you going to do to get to know your neighbors? You all can do one thing that everybody else in this room can do. You're ordinary people. But you can do something that probably no other Christian in your area is doing. You can reach out to your neighbors and invite them to a meal at your house. Not to preach the gospel, not to watch Billy Graham on television, not to do anything like that, but to show them compassion, love, and interest, and to begin to have conversations about life that might eventually lead to them getting to know you as a Christian, a follower of Jesus Christ. Summer's coming. Fire up the grill, put on some hamburgers or chicken or whatever you like to cook, and go around the neighborhood and say, Saturday afternoon, we're just going to have a little grill, a little cookout. Come on by if you have time. Sit them down at the table, share life together, get to know them. How about the possibilities of a shared meal? Very briefly, let's talk about the possibility of the people who can do it. Well, some of you are really gifted with the gift of hospitality. I won't mention names here, but I think all of us could identify some people that we know just seem to be really good at having people over and making them feel comfortable and, you know, fixing a nice meal or just doing something special together. Some of you, just you're attentive to that, and maybe you're gifted at that in a special way. Well, the rest of us are not so gifted, so we maybe have to do a little bit more planning. Won't be so spontaneous. At first, it might not seem as relaxed because we'll be a little bit nervous. But all of us can do that. All of us know people. All of us can do something to gather people at our dinner table. And we'll talk about there's other options besides your dinner table. Even if it's a potluck supper, because you're not a good cook. Okay? Maybe you've got a great casserole that you know how to fix, but you're... Just, you know, forget it when it comes to dessert. We'll just say, hey, do you mind bringing the dessert? Come on over. Bring something for dessert. Cookies will be fine. Brownies will be fine. A carton of ice cream will be fine. Just come on over. You can figure out how to put that together. A simple cookout during the summer. A little invitation just for dessert and coffee. Okay? And you can buy the dessert someplace. Okay? It doesn't have to be something that you make. Maybe you're a single adult and you really don't have a place where you could entertain anybody. So invite somebody to go to a restaurant with you and have lunch together. Have a meal together. Bring their kids, whatever. You can find another place to do the same thing. It could be Dutch treat. Everybody pays for their own. But you're letting them sit down together with you. And it's not in your home, but it's in the best place that you can find. By the way, singles are often the most overlooked and easily overlooked people in the church when it comes to extending hospitality. Let me just make you sensitive about that, okay? We have a lot of single adults in our church. And it would be a shame that they hear about all these wonderful opportunities that people are getting to go over to other people's homes, and it's couples inviting couples. And there are never any single adults invited. That hurts. That hurts. And so please, let's be sensitive and loving and try to think, are there any single adults we should be inviting as well as married adults to come and visit with us? Now, some of our single adults are married, but they're single in the Lord. And here's where an invitation to your home to have a meal can break down barriers, because that spouse who's not an active follower of Jesus might find it much easier to go with their spouse, the believer, to another person's home and just have a meal than they would to come to church. And so you're breaking down some barriers and establishing friendships with that person. What kinds of meals could you have? Well, I leave that up to you, but some of you are good cooks, so you'd prepare your own meals. Others of you would probably order something out, even if it was just pizza or hot wings. Just depends on what your folks like. A cookout's usually a pretty simple thing to put together. You can just have chips. You don't have to have all those side dishes. You can have hamburger and chips and some pickles, and that'll do it. You could have dessert and coffee. Again, you don't have to bring that. You can go out for ice cream or just have somebody over for ice cream, or you can have coffee with somebody. Who could be invited? Well, pretty much everybody. People in the church, married and unmarried, visitors to the church. There used to be a couple in our church years ago that tried very intentionally to, on Sunday nights, always have a meal ready so that they could invite a guest on Sunday morning to come Sunday night to their house and have that little meal. They fixed waffles. Became known as the waffle ministry to some of us. They always had waffles. She made pretty good waffles, as a matter of fact. I'd had some. And so they would invite people every Sunday. They didn't always have somebody come, but they were ready. If somebody came to church, they could visit. So a visitor to the church. A neighbor, a coworker, a friend. Now, even strangers could become guests at your table, and we'll have to talk about that in just a few minutes. Well, planning for a shared meal. That's simple, isn't it? The first thing I need to do is decide to do it and get it on the calendar. Then we're committed. A week from Saturday, we're going to try to have a cookout, and we're going to try to invite our neighbors. Let's get started. Get over the strangeness of it or the discomfort. Let's go knock on doors and just say, come on over. You know, we don't know each other very well. Let's just get together. Decide who you want to invite. Invite the people. And remember, formal invitations are rarely, if ever, used anymore. You don't need to send them a little card. Would you come over to the house, RSVP? You know, knock on their door. Send them a text message, email if you need to do that, Snapchat, whatever you use, social media, and just get people to come, right? And say, hey, we're getting together. Some of us are getting together at the house next Saturday. I'd love to have you come. We're going to have about four o'clock, from about 4 to 6, we're just going to barbecue out. Come on by. And then get things ready and be ready for the first people to arrive. The reason I'm taking this out of order is because just this week in my inbox, my email box, most of which is stuff that gets thrown out right away, there was an article written by a man whose parents had a reputation for hospitality. He's going to tell you about this in just a minute. This man was being interviewed, and somebody wrote down this information and then added other information about this issue of hospitality. And he entitled his message, now I was going to do Lydia anyway, but later in the year, he entitled his article, "The Most Underused," I forget what they said, "Evangelistic Tool in the Church Tool Bag," something like that. And it was a picture of a dining room table, you know, with a plate. And so I said, well, yeah, that's right, that is true. And he gave some ideas from his experience in using hospitality. I thought I'd just read them to you. The fellow's name was Wes Yoder. Now, if you come from my neck of the woods down in eastern Pennsylvania, Yoder is a Pennsylvania Dutch name, okay? And sure enough, Mr. Yoder is a Pennsylvania Dutchman. He said, one of the first things I learned from my parents is this: there's always room at the table for a friend. At his parents' farm in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, anybody been to Lancaster? Okay, you know the farms, beautiful farms down there. Anyone who came to the door was a friend. So there's always room at the table for him. The family didn't have much, but they were always willing to share. When his parents died, Yoder inherited stacks of their guest books, stretching from the 1940s to the 2000s, 60 years. They included the names of everyone who came for dinner, from the homeless men who'd knock at the back door to government dignitaries from around the world. They came to see us because we were charming little Mennonites, he said. Ah, yes. Yoder says in recent years he's hosted dinners for friends on a monthly basis. They get together, eat a meal, and share their lives. Yoder says too much of our time is consumed with technology and the busyness of life. We neglect to do the simple things that create friendships. The kitchen table, the supper table, is the least used asset in the kingdom of God, he said. We do not invite strangers to our home. We barely invite our friends over for dinner. Hopefully, that will change. The reporter goes on, the writer goes on to say, meals don't have to be something special. He said, I have a friend in Chicago who used to host a soup night for her friends every week. She'd toss on a pot of soup, warm up some bread, and invite people in. Her home became one of the most popular spots in the neighborhood. He said, in New Orleans, there's a journalist by the name of Pablo, I hope I'm saying this right, Johnson, who's been cooking red beans and rice for neighbors and friends every Monday for the past 15 years. Can you cook red beans and rice? You could. Not sure it's as popular up here as it would be down in Louisiana, but he does. He started when he was new to town and needed to make friends. Hey, sounds like a great idea. And he's kept it up ever since, feeding friends at his grandmother's kitchen table. It's such a great place to learn from people you know and people you don't. And there's always enough for someone who shows up. You can always make more rice, he said. In McCreary County, Kentucky, one of the poorest communities in America, a church started feeding its neighbors free sit-down meals at lunch every week about 7 years ago. The congregation of Crossroads Community Baptist Church had rented out a shuttered restaurant to hold Sunday services, and the building still had a functional commercial kitchen. The light bulb went off. In a community where hunger is a real problem, members thought, why not start cooking? These days, the church serves about 200 sit-down meals a week and hosts more than 1,000 people every year for Thanksgiving. Servers pray with everyone, and anybody who walks in the door is greeted like a long-lost friend. He talks about a chance that he had to talk with another Christian leader who's now with the Lord. His name was Mike Iaconelli. He was a co-founder of a youth ministry group called Youth Specialties. And he said this. He said, our secular pagan culture, Iaconelli said this, doesn't make us get drunk. It makes us dull. We don't sit around thinking, how can I redeem this situation? We have lost the power of the tiny, of the small, of the little thoughtful things that we can do for each other that make all the difference in the world. That's what happens in a pagan world, pagan culture. It's not that we run around doing these horrible sins. It's that we don't run around doing these little acts of grace that we ought to be doing. Lydia did that little act of grace. She opened up her home to a man, a group of men she hardly knew. And from that point on, cemented a lasting relationship with those men and provided for the church to have a place to meet and for the missionaries to be supported, not only there, but in other places where they ministered. The power of the dining room table. The power of a shared meal. That's what I hope we'll remember. And maybe we'll start using the most underutilized resource in the church. And that's our supper table. And we'll find a way to bring people to our table. Let's stand with heads bowed and eyes closed. Now, Father, we thank you that there was such a woman named Lydia, and Paul did not have to struggle in his ministry there in Philippi, and he didn't have to struggle in Thessalonica. Both places were very difficult, hard places for him to minister. But he was freed from concern because somebody cared enough to open up her house. Thank you for Lydia. Thank you for her lasting testimony. Lord, thank you for Martha and the loving care that she gave to Jesus, the meals that they enjoyed together, and the long and deep friendship that was established between them. We pray, Father, that you will make us gracious hospitality givers, gracious hosts and hostesses, that maybe we'll begin to use this tool even this summer to gather people around our table, begin to share life together, and maybe eventually to get to turn an everyday conversation into a gospel conversation. As heads are bowed and eyes are closed, I want to invite you, if you're a non-Christian, that is, you're not yet sure that you've received Christ as your Savior, maybe you're still even just thinking about the whole process, to consider coming to Christ today, to surrender your heart and your life to Jesus, and to say, I want to follow Him from this point on in my life. But maybe you don't know what to do, you don't know the right words to say, you don't know how to take the first steps. So we're going to invite you to come, slip out the aisle, come to meet me here at the front, and just say, Pastor Mark, that's me. I just need that first step. I'm not sure what I need to do, but I need to do it. Maybe you've already taken that step. Maybe you already received Christ as your Savior, but you haven't yet followed Christ in believer's baptism. Maybe you need to unite with the church, and you need to say, I'm going to put my membership here. I'm going to be counted on here. I'm going to be one of the people who will move this church forward into the next 20 years of its life. I'll do my best to serve God in this church. So as heads are bowed and eyes are closed, I'll be here. You may come and you may share with us your needs. Others will be coming so they can pray with you and answer questions that you might have. Come right away.